Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Roy. I'm a commercial interior designer with a passion for creating beautiful functional spaces. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of working on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a lot of knowledge to share. To create this podcast for you, on most episodes, I've teamed up with my good friend, interior designer and architectural designer, Cheryl Sutton. She's not here today, but on other episodes, when we do team up together, we have very opposing views and it does make for some lively discussions. So check out those other episodes. I started this podcast because I feel strongly about interior design and the importance of educating designers. A lot of what you'll hear from us, you won't learn in a course. As designers, there's so much we need to know to do our jobs well, and we want to give you a forum where you can access the information you need wherever you are. Whether you're an aspiring designer, someone designing your own home, or a seasoned professional working in residential or commercial design, this podcast is here to help you improve and thrive. We're not about ego-stroking interviews with big names. Instead, we focus on practical advice that you can apply directly to your work. You'll learn about different products, their applications, and sustainability practices. Our goal is to equip you with the knowledge you need to excel in your projects. And remember, if it's not fun, we're not going to do it. So expect a bit of humour, a few swear words, and a few innuendos. Now, a quick note on production. We are interior designers, not sound producers. I am handling the editing myself, so please don't judge. Please be patient with me. I'm improving my production skills as the podcast progresses, but if there are any sound editors out there who would like to offer their services in return for a mention, please reach out. Thanks for tuning into the Interior Design Podcast. Today, our guest is Hannah Temple. I met Hannah recently on a yoga retreat. She inspired the hell out of me, and I want you guys to have a little piece of that. She's really, really passionate. She's sustainability guru, and I have learned so much from her already, and I hope to learn a little bit more about her on the podcast that we're going to do. Hannah is the founder of the Teal Collective, and she's also a member of the Green Party. So I really just wanted to share with you guys who Hannah is, what she does, and what she's got to say, because what she's got to say is really important. I hope you enjoy. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
This is Hannah Temple, the amazing Hannah Temple. And this is Harvey, who's exposing himself a little bit more than I'd like. He's joining us for the podcast today.
I'm very excited about our conversation.
Anyone who's listening and not looking needs to go onto YouTube and see Harvey. Harvey is making his debut on the Interior Design Podcast today.
And what a debut.
Oh, he's beautiful, isn't he? Today, I'm joined by the lovely, amazing, beautiful Hannah Temple, who I recently met on a yoga retreat, the most amazing yoga retreat. Mm. Hannah is the founder of the Teal Collective.
I am indeed.
Tell us about the Teal Collective, Hannah.
Oh, well, I also just before we start, I want to say how lovely it is to be with you, having met you in a woodland near Bath not long ago, and just, yeah, a wonderful kind of serendipitous meeting. But also how wonderful it is to be here with you and with Harvey, who's lying here next to us in a very relaxed position. So as you say, I'm the founder of an organization called the Teal Collective, and the Teal Collective is a collective consultancy. We specialize in helping organizations to learn from nature and to become really regenerative forces in the world. And I can say more later about why teal, if that's interesting, but maybe just as some other context in terms of some other hats that I wear that may or may not weave their way into our conversation today. So I recently had the honor and the privilege of being the Green Party's parliamentary candidate for the area where I live.
I'm converted. I am.
Excellent, excellent. Well, as much of that as I can do, the better. Yeah, and would love to stand again if I'm selected. And I host a podcast too. So I host a podcast called A Thriving Future, which is where people can encounter other organizations who are also on the path to regenerative. And the intention of that podcast is so people can hear their stories, learn about what they're doing, what's working, what's not. And finally, I'm part of and helped initiate an organization, an initiative called the Earth Funding Lab. So I know an amazing woman called Florence Miller, who is the director of the Environmental Funders Network. And so, as the name suggests, it's a network of funders, big philanthropic institutions or also individuals, a real mix of people within the philanthropic space who want to see more action around the environment. And what she really noticed was that there was a real kind of, well, a lot of issues with the efficacy of a lot of the money going into environmental protection, and that lots of funders were working kind of in silos, not really connecting to one another, not working collaboratively, and also not working at a systems level, tending to kind of look at little symptoms rather than actually using their money and their resource to sort of try and shift the underlying systemic issues. And so we created a lab, a kind of program and a community for funders to come together to learn and unlearn about, well, the guiding star within the lab is around, how do we create an economy that serves life? How do we create an economy where that is the real priority? And so we brought together a group of funders who are curious about working towards that question, who want to work together. And so the program is a space to sort of learn about what an economy that serves life might look like, and also how to do philanthropy and funding differently so that they can kind of be part of a solution or a move towards something different. Yeah, so it's really exciting. And actually, if anyone is curious to join, anyone listening is in a funding position or role or curious about that world, then we're starting what we call the base camp training, which is kind of the on-ramp for the lab, if anyone is curious.
Exciting.
Thank you.
So after all that, you now know why Hannah is sitting with me, because she's amazing and she's got so much experience in the whole sustainability, regenerative area that I really wanted Hannah to come onto the Interior Design Podcast to teach us a thing or two about how we can be more sustainable and regenerative in what we do as interior designers or anyone who's aspiring to be a designer. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, not at all. Such a pleasure.
So first of all, what advice have you got for interior designers?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think probably a lot. And I think, and I tend to kind of avoid saying advice lots of thoughts, I suppose, around kind of the connection between interior design and the idea of being more regenerative. But maybe it's helpful just briefly explain what I mean by regenerative as a start point. So because the word regenerative, which is something which has really exploded in use, we're seeing it in lots of different sectors. It's really kind of a bit of a buzzword, but there is no kind of one uniform definition of what regenerative is or what a regenerative business is. So my definition, what I use, what I think is the simplest and clearest definition of it, is something that is regenerative is something that creates conditions for the greater thriving of life. And I think there are three key things about that definition which are really important to notice. One is that we're talking about thriving. We're not just talking about the survival of life. We're talking about its true flourishing, the optimizing of life's potential. So we're not just aiming for like a mediocre goal. We really want thriving. This is an ambitious thing. Secondly, when we talk about life, that's a really holistic understanding of life. So we're not just talking about humans. Obviously, we are talking about humans and all humans, but we're not just talking about humans. We're talking about all life on this planet, all of the animals, all of the plants, all of the bacteria, mycelium, viruses, all of the life on this planet. We want to see, we're talking about life thriving. And crucially, we're not just talking about life thriving now. We're looking at what is the greater thrive? What can we do to support the greater thriving of life into the long term, future generations of life on this planet? And that holistic balance of interconnecting life. And the final thing, the final third thing about the definition is that we're talking about the greater thriving of life. So being regenerative is not a destination. It's not, okay, we as an organization or as an initiative, we've done X, Y, and Z.
done. We're regenerative. Tick. We can pat ourselves on the back and applaud ourselves. No. Being regenerative is kind of, it's a more fundamental shift. We're not just kind of replacing maybe what's been there for sustainability or various other different kind of certifications and things that are in place with a new sort of set of checklists. Being regenerative is about a different way of being in the world. It's like a fundamental shift at not only a head level, but really at a heart level as well. And so when we talk about it being the greater thriving of life, it's a recognition that this is not a destination. This is a constant way of being, a constant process of evolution. Because in the same way that in nature, nothing is ever still, nothing is still, everything is always adapting, evolving, changing. And that is what we mean by regenerative, is something that is constantly seeking the greater thriving of life. So that's kind of what I mean by regenerative. And there's a whole world of what I could say about how that translates to business and organizations. But I wonder.
I mean, I think that what something you just said there was really hit home, because I, as a designer, I really struggle to choose the most sustainable products. I want to do that all the time and I try and do that all the time. But how do I know? And actually, I think by you saying, you know, it's a constant thing, it is about working with people to try and get that, you know, that shift, isn't it? It's about working with suppliers, because suppliers aren't going to just change from cradle, you know, into cradle to cradle if that's not what they've been doing before, for example. So if you are working with the suppliers and you know that you're kind of, you're looking for sustainable stuff and you do choose sustainable stuff when you can, I feel like I don't feel so bad. Do you know what I mean? I constantly go, I don't know if I'm doing this right in terms of sustainability, you know?
Yeah. And I think the issue, like I say, is it's more of a systemic problem, because it should, in the same way as I don't think it's, you know, right that any individual, when they go to the supermarket, is like, do I buy the organic apples or the local ones or the fair trade ones? You know,
so
you're going,
choices,
what's the right call? And really what I think should happen is that, you know, at a systemic level, we should only be offering products in stores that meet minimum criteria, and that it shouldn't be down to the individual to have to do 10 hours of research to decide what carpet to buy. You know, it should be, there should be minimum standards legislated. That's not where we are now. And so I know one of the things that we talked about a bit when we met and that maybe sparked a little bit of how we ended up here was, you know, you were sharing that frustration with me of, you know, I have to make choices about who I buy things from. I have to make choices about what suppliers I work with. And I just feel a bit in the dark about how to do that in the best way. And yeah, I mean, I suppose, from where I sit, so I spent a lot of my career working in sustainability and human rights, so a lot of time in supply chains, on factories, in farms, in offices around the world. And there's a lot of very unpleasant stuff that happens environmentally and socially. But there are also, I think, a lot of, it's really important to remember that there are human beings at every stage of those supply chains. And I think what I ended up talking to you about in terms of the, I think one of the strongest ways to navigate, you know, trying to have more sustainable, more ethical supply chains, is trying to build trusting, open, human relationships with your suppliers. Because if you're a supplier, often you're squeezed between a rock and a hard place in many different scenarios and contracts. You often have very short-term contracts, or you have very long lead times for when you get paid. And you often are, you know, someone else's customer. So they'll be buying things from another supplier and another supplier and another supplier. And their degree of visibility on ultimately where things come from is often really compromised. So when they have their ultimate customer say to us, well, look, I'm only going to give you this size order, and I'm not going to pay you for another 8 months, but can you make sure that you tick all these boxes, please, and jump through all these hoops? What that does is that overly incentivizes the supplier to go, yeah, sure, I meet all of that. Absolutely, because that's the answer that they know you're looking for. They know that you as the customer just want them to say, yes, I meet all those criteria. Please, can we now get on and do the business? And so what that tends to mean is that all of the damaging effects in supply chains, most customers never even hear about, never mind can be in a position where they can be actually supporting, you know, where we can actually be changing the situation. The best thing that we can really be aiming for are relationships with suppliers where there is trust, where there's openness, where someone could possibly say to you, I know you want, you know, this carbon neutral material, or I know you want this wood that comes from these sustainable forests, but the truth of the matter is that I'm buying it from these guys and they tell me these things, but then I've also heard this. And so I need your help, customer, to figure out what we do here. That's the place you want to be, where you actually have some idea of the scenario, because I'm telling you now, whatever you are buying, there are issues. There is, unless you are buying something that is like made by your neighbor from, you know, materials that they are growing, there are social and environmental issues associated with whatever the things are, whether it's furniture, whether it's paint, there are issues. And so the most crucial thing is that we try and encourage a state where there's actually the trust and the openness to talk about those issues and to be able to try and navigate ways forward together.
Mm. I think it's really interesting. While you were saying that, I was thinking about supply, some of the suppliers that I've worked with massive corporations. Mm-hmm. One of my suppliers actually went bust because of one of the big supermarkets didn't pay them for a few months, or a lot more than a few months. Mm. And, you know, it's the big corporations, isn't it, that are doing the worst damage. Mm. But yeah, we need some regulation, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think regulation is a massive thing, you know, and certainly, you know, that's why the kind of Green Party and my work in regenerative business and regenerative organizations comes together, is because so often I see so many organizations who are like, I want to do all these things, but it means I have to kind of go away and get a degree in whatever the particular thing is to be able to just feel like I'm making a good decision. And it's putting me at a competitive disadvantage often, because I have no guarantee that other organizations are doing it either. And so that's why we absolutely need to see. And, you know, there's a myth out there, in particularly in government, that businesses don't want regulation. And in my experience of having worked with organizations for 13 years, they absolutely say, I would like a level playing field.
Yeah.
I want to know that my competitors have to jump through the same hoops that I do. I want to know that we're all working towards the same thing. And most organizations recognize that we want a future where our environment isn't destroyed, where we do still have soils that can produce crops, where we do have healthy air and less pollution, where we don't have people who are so impoverished that they do desperate things. That's not good for anyone's business. So they really recognize that actually we do need these minimum standards so that they don't feel like there's a disincentive from kind of protecting their own future as a business.
Yeah, I mean, having worked in business for a long time, one of the things that I really try and do is understand that everyone has to make a profit. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not in business to not make a profit. You're there to make money, and everyone has to make money. So, and when you get a client who understands that, everything becomes more fair, you know, and one of the things that in my younger years, I had people influencing me where, you know, you've got to screw down to the best price and, you know, all the supply chain things, that the brutal supply chain things that happen a lot.
Yeah.
I was taught in that world, and I didn't like it. I stepped out of it because I was just like, oh, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to screw somebody because they'll screw me back. And that's exactly what happened. You know, I ended up screwing someone down on price, and the quality was affected.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help anyone, you know? And so if you work together, and this is what happens when I manage a project, if you work together as a team and you respect each other,
yeah,
then you get a better product out of it. At the end, you get a better service. And that's the same thing with the environment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and as you say, the kind of the cost savings that you get through that kind of approach tend to be very short-sighted, or even maybe not even there at all. Because as you say, there have been certainly organizations that I've worked with before who've had a similar approach, you know, really, really pushed their sales teams to be aggressive at cost cutting and so on. And then there's ended up with a huge scandal of, you know, a child's labor has been found in one of their factories. And you're going, well,
Happen.
Yeah, exactly. What other option did they have? Or, you know, huge long hours being worked because they've placed a huge order at very limited time frame. You know, it's like this is not quantum physics. You can see that these are connected. And yeah, and so then you then pay the cost of the reputational scandal. You pay the cost of the fact that, yeah, children, if you're having children in your factory, I have to tell you, as someone who's visited a lot of factories, if there is a factory where that kind of thing is happening, that is not the factory that has great quality. That is not the factory that is producing you really reliable, high quality products. You are paying that cost in a whole load of different ways. So it's really, really short-sighted. And I do want to kind of shout out you know, a number of organizations who are doing things differently. And there is a furniture manufacturer called Vitso, who I think do a lot of really fantastic things in this space that I think are relevant to lots of other areas of kind of interior design. So, and the thing that's directly connected to what we're just talking about is that they do not incentivize their sales teams by sales. They incentivize them by selling the right amount of product, and it's designed for the really long term. So they say, we're not trying to do newer, we're trying to do better. Their sales teams are encouraged to directly undersell, to say, if you're not sure, have less, and you can always have more, you know, you can always get more of it. You can always add more things on if you want. Please have less. Make sure that you only take what you really need, so that we minimize consumerism, we minimize waste. And they also, their products are designed in a kind of modular fashion, so that you can, if you buy this armchair, you can extend it to become a sofa. If you buy this shelving unit, you can mix it around and add other things to it. It's modular, it adapts, so that when, because another way in which I think this idea of kind of supporting more regenerative thinking around interior design is, interior design has become a bit more like fashion, right? It's become very like fast, lots of different seasons. People are like, oh my goodness, we haven't redesigned our bedroom for 2 years. Oh my God, we've got to redo it. And, you know, that can be extremely damaging in terms of waste if we're chucking things out and beginning from scratch each time. What if our interior design was really built around, how can we create spaces that are really adaptable? That mean that, okay, with just a few tweaks, you can get a completely different look. Okay, if we, you know, like in the same way as this manufacturer has done, how can I offer you a piece of furniture or whatever, a soft furnishing that has a whole load of different uses, has a whole load of different ways in which it can be updated in terms of the color or the look, without you needing to have a whole new set of resources and materials. And this business has demonstrated that that works economically for them, because the people, the word of mouth that they now have, because the quality of their products is so phenomenal, and people just love experiencing their furniture because it's so well designed.
Where is this company?
Vitso. They're actually now based in the UK, but their background, the main designer, who's amazing, he's come up with these fantastic principles for design. I think he was German. Don't quote me on that. I can send you a link. Yeah, I think there are so many ways in which kind of being regenerative really links into interior design. And sales is a massive thing, making sure that we're not just saying, push it, get as much out as we can. One of the core principles of nature that I kind of weave into a lot of my work is optimization. Our societies and our businesses and our organizations are often geared towards maximization. How can we squeeze as much profit, product, whatever, out of this thing as possible? That tends to be extremely short-sighted, because that tends to push things to places where they become stressed and break. We've seen that again and again and again in financial crises, in what we can see in the natural world around us, whereas nature operates by the principle of optimization. How can as many parts of the system be thriving at the same time as possible? How can we have that holistic balance? How can people be well? How can they be operating in really lovely spaces? How can the people who work in their supply chains be well? How can the overall system be strong, resilient, and able to carry on for an indefinite future, rather than at the minute squeeze as much out of it for 5 minutes and then suffer the consequences afterwards? It's a crazy.
One of the things that you said there about kind of saying, you know, only have what you need. I tend to be a bit like that with my clients when I go in, you know, go in with a full interior design proposal. And I quite often go, if you don't need all of this, don't have it. Like, I don't want you to have anything you don't want, you know? And I think when you behave like that, it actually builds trust. Because, yeah. I'm busy enough. I don't need all of this work. If you've got a massive project for me, great. But if you haven't, I'll find one somewhere else, you know? So when you have that attitude, people tend to be a bit more trusting. Whereas if you're kind of desperate to get the sale kind of thing, people tend to be like, oh, you know,
yeah,
what do they want out of me? Whereas if you kind of go, well, there's my proposal, don't have it if you don't want it, yeah, you know, only have what you need, actually that tends to build a better relationship from the beginning. Yeah. And that's the same thing, isn't it?
Well, I think you're demonstrating there that you have their interests at heart. You know, you are actually serving them rather than just trying to extract from them. And yeah, and then I think that, like, we would all say that, right? If anyone treats us in a way that feels extractive, you're like, oh my goodness. Whereas if someone's clearly there trying to support you, inquire about what you really want, then that's the kind of conversation you want to continue.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. So what else are we going to talk about today?
Well, I would love to talk about the idea of regenerative in interior design and in kind of design in spaces, if that's...
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. What are your thoughts on...
So...
How do we designers do it better in terms of regenerative and sustainable?
So I think there are... So I have a framework for what it means to be a regenerative organisation. I think part of how you do design work better is also about how you operate as an organisation yourself. And that kind of links to the framework that I use for regenerative organisations is in the form of a tree metaphor. So, and what that does is kind of just try and help people see all of the different ways in all of the different aspects of organizational activity that relate to the idea of creating conditions for the greater thriving of life. So the soil represents the organization's fundamental legal structure, fundamental financing, origin story. It's like the fundamental groundings of the organization. Are those structures that fundamentally prioritize the greater thriving of life, or do they prioritize profit? Those things can make a massive difference to the freedom that an organization has to really be able to put the thriving of life first. Second thing is your root network, which is all of your relationships. That's what we've been talking about with the supplier relationships. What's the quality and the nature of those relationships? When you talk about a tree, you want that tree to have lots of roots, for those roots to be deep, for there to be a reciprocal relationship. There's materials coming from the soil. There's also energy coming down from the leaves. You have this balanced reciprocity, but those relationships are deep and strong. So that's in your team, but also with your suppliers, with your customers, exactly what you were talking about, the trust you're building with your customers. That root network is key. Your trunk is everything internal to your organization. And I break that down into three sections. The bark, which is probably where we can go in a second, is around what's the physical environment like in which your operations are happening? What's the nature of your factory? What's the nature of your office, et cetera, et cetera. Your sapwood is all of your processes, your policies, your KPIs, your governance structures, your internal workings. And the heartwood at the center of your trunk are the values, the beliefs, the worldviews that inhabit your organization. Then you have the fruits, flowers, and foliage, which is what you put out into the world. So as an interior design business, it's your services, but it's also your waste. It's your messaging. It's your reporting. It's everything that you're putting out into the world. What's the nature and quality of those things? What do they do and add to the world? And the final thing is materials. Materials is what is flowing through your organization. Yes, in terms of raw materials, like maybe you buy a whole load of computers and what happens to them afterwards. But it's also things like money. How is money flowing through your organization? How is it operating like a nutrient, like a material? How do you make sure you have enough, but not so much that it's unhelpful? How is it flowing easily from where you make it to where it can be put to good use? So there's one way I would answer your question that would be to say, by being an example of a regenerative business yourself, by incorporating kind of nature's wisdom across those different areas. But I think to speak to the bark specifically, the kind of the nature of the environments that you create in your work, there's a lot that I kind of look to as sort of examples of more regenerative design. One of those things is, okay, are the spaces that you're creating allowing people greater connection to the natural world? Are there spaces for natural light, connection to natural materials, natural sounds? There is so much data which demonstrates that when people have access to the outside or to natural light, so in hospitals, for example, they require less pain medication, they recover quicker. When any of us spend time in a forest rather than in an urban environment, our blood pressure decreases, our cortisol levels decrease. There are huge kind of well-being benefits to being in connection with natural materials. That can be a cork floor, that can be plants in the space, that can be just big open spaces, there can be a water feature, you know, just natural, those things that actually connect us with the fact that we are nature. That is a core thing in terms of well-being. And also making sure that those spaces are really kind of biophilic. They encourage, and that means like love of nature, they support and encourage that creativity, that focus. Oh, that's another thing that happens when you spend time with natural environments, is you get greater focus, greater memory. All of these things are amazing. And often if you're designing spaces where people want to be at work, you're at an office or a home office or whatever it is, like There are lots of benefits.
Biophilic has been in fashion for a while and it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've just put some plants in our office, which are rubberwood plants, and they give out loads of oxygen and they just feel really nice as well. So, you know, if the more, you know, if you haven't got great ventilation in your office, having real plants that are going to pull in the carbon dioxide and kick out the oxygen is actually going to make you feel much better.
Exactly.
So yeah, I love biophilic. Mm-hmm. If you know my website, you'll know.
Excellent.
You'll know that I love a bit of a plant. Plants and everywhere. I actually put it in my proposals now, plant plan. And I'm like, people are like, why do I need a plan for plants? Because I'm going to put a lot in there.
Oh yeah.
If you let me.
Oh yeah. Gorgeous.
So in terms of, there was a couple of things I was thinking about then. As an interior designer, I mean, we've heard in a previous podcast, Cradle to Cradle Sustainability, when we were talking to Lewis Pullen about how 50% of the waste that goes into landfill comes from construction.
Mm.
And ever since I heard that, I have been on a bit of a mission to not put anything into landfill unnecessarily. So that is why there's an enormous pile of furniture over there, which I've got on Facebook Marketplace, and I keep going, do you want some desks? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm trying to repurpose it all and sell it for a fiver or a tenner or give it away for free if I have to. You know, and try and just move that, because it came out of an office where the guy was going to put it in the skip, and I was like, no, you can't do that. Deliver it to my warehouse and I'll get rid of it somehow. So there's that. The other thing as well is, what about waste? So as a designer, I have a lot of cardboard waste and things like that. So I recycle cardboard and plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got another bin, which is everything else. But in a corporate environment, we don't have a food bin like you would at home and stuff like that. So in terms of recycling, how do I do that better? Is there any organizations that will recycle?
Oh,
more
yeah.
than just because we're with Viola. I think it's Viola.
Oh, yeah. So absolutely. And you're talking about specifically like within your office, your like immediate operations.
Designer,
yeah.
Rubbish. Where do we, mm-hmm. you know, how do we better recycle as a business? Because, you know, these guys are like, oh, that's all we do. We don't recycle food.
Yeah. And most people won't have a choice over the kind of local authorities, you know, choice of contractor for your waste disposal and things. So there will always be limitations to that. But I would say two things. So firstly, it's about the choices that you make initially, you know, so obviously trying to prevent anything, because ultimately what we want to get to, and certainly, again, if we look at nature, there's no such thing as waste. Everything that's produced forms part of a new cycle. And I know the idea of kind of circular economics and cradle to cradle, like these have become very, very popular and much more kind of more widespread. But absolutely, the idea of waste should become redundant. You have resources that change. You know, oh, okay, so there was a desk. Now, what does it become? What are the different phases of the life cycle? Because there should be no waste. There is no waste in nature. Things just form part of different cycles. That's really what we want to aim for. Where we are now is so doing what we can initially to think about the things that we bring into our organizations, to sort of think, well, is this something that's immediately going to create a load of redundant waste? Is this going to be something that, like there's going to be a load of packaging on it that I'm not going to know what to do with, or this is designed to only last for 2 years, and so in 2 years I'm going to have this challenge or whatever. The second thing is, yes, there are organizations who are set up to help you recycle things that are not traditionally recycled by major waste providers. So TerraCycle is terrible name, but TerraCycle is an amazing initiative. They tend to work at a kind of community level. So like where I live, we have in various different parts of kind of the town, there'll be places where you can take the things that, you can't normally recycle. So things like toothpaste tubes or your batteries, although you can do them elsewhere. When it comes to things like your blister packs for your tablets and things, there are like different points, crisp packets, all these different things that typically can't be recycled, you can take them there. So I think depending on the nature of the waste, again, waste in inverted commas, but of the nature of the materials, the resources that you find yourself kind of not knowing what to do with, it would be interesting maybe within your industry to see whether there are specific places, you know, like if there are things like, you know, because again, furniture must be a massive,
huge,
a massive thing where there will be outlets, avenues for that. And I think more and more people and organizations are recognizing the need for that support. And more people are interested in upcycling, second life, pre-loved. It's become a major thing. And I think as an organization, the first thing you want to do is prevent that in the first place. Try and make sure that you're not choosing things that are going to not last you for a really, really, really long time. But secondly, if you do have things that you can't make use of anymore, to really, really try and make sure that they have an opportunity to just form, you know, have enter a different phase of their life cycle rather than, just being shoved in the ground.
Yeah. And this is the thing is the thing about construction and interior design is you are kind of ripping it out and starting again a lot of the time. And I always look at everything from a, how can I recycle that? How can I reuse that? And then client's like, no, I've had that for 20 years. You can't reuse that. And I'm like, yes, you can. It's made of wood.
Yeah.
And it's fine. I just need to fix it up and it'll be, put a new upholstery pad on it. And, that kind of thing. I think having that attitude with everything, because I'm a bit of an eco warrior when it comes to that. But it doesn't, if you were a designer who was making an awful lot of money out of selling furniture, then you're going to be less likely to behave like that.
Well, yes, I know. As I say, like examples like Vitzo are proving that, no, it really does. That is a short-sighted aim. And if you have a board of trustees, if you have a CEO whose fiduciary duty is to make sure that you're protecting, stewarding the interests of that business, acting in that way is not in the business's long-term interests. Because look around at what's happening to our forests, look around at what's happening to our oceans, look around what's happening to our societies. This is a really short-term ambition. And the kind of like, okay, yeah, we also have a duty to maximize profits for our shareholders. Yeah, you do. But that's completely in contradiction often to your motive to steward the interests of the organization for the long-term. And so I would say that is the motivation that you need to make sure if you want to be a business at all, never mind a thriving business in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years beyond, you need to be shifting this perspective to say, okay, it's not just about maximizing profit now. It's about thinking about how we can be a legitimate, valid business that's really offering a service that people want and need. And hey, look, if you're doing your job, you're looking around at these trends. Oh, look at how well Vinted the organization is doing that's selling secondhand clothes. Look at and there's a Vinted for furniture, I believe. Vinterias, is that right?
Oh my God, I didn't know about this. Vinterias,
that might be a place to get rid of your desks.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, if you are a sensible business person, you are conscious of what's happening in the pulse in the trends around you. And this is only growing. People are saying, I don't want the things that I'm buying to make me feel terrible, to make me think that I am hurting people in other parts of the world, that I am contributing a whole load of pollution. I don't want to buy goods that are just I'm going to need to throw away and that's going to leach toxic chemicals into the ground. I don't want that. My children are looking at me and going, why aren't you doing things better, mummy, daddy? Everyone I'm speaking to is feeling that pressure, is recognizing that there is a responsibility for all of us, no matter what job we do, no matter what sector we work in, to be doing everything we can to try and support the greater thriving of our planet and all the life on it, the people who we know and love and all the people who we have yet to meet.
Well said. Love that. I love you so much.
Oh, likewise.
This is why I brought Hannah on board. She's so passionate about what you're so passionate about what you do and you just live it. It's great. when Hannah and I met, we met and we were like, oh, hello. Sat next to each other at having dinner, eating our vegan food in our yoga retreat. And we were both like, oh, I've got a podcast. Oh, I've got a podcast. Oh, my God. we were chatting all night that night where we were like trying to put the world to rights about sustainability. And I was like, oh, my God, you're amazing.
Oh, well, likewise, that was just such an amazing, amazing retreat full of awesome, awesome people. And yeah, it was just a delight always to kind of meet people that you can just geek out with.
Yeah, we did yoga last night. Hannah was like, I'm coming up to Essex, can we do yoga and do a podcast? I'm like, yes, definitely. So what else have we got to talk about? So you are one of the initiators of the Earth Funding Lab. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the Earth Funding Lab comes from An amazing person I know called Florence Miller is currently the director of the Environmental Funders Network. And as the name suggests, that's a network of funders who are passionate about trying to support environmental causes. But what Florence and many others have noticed is that the philanthropic space, despite the huge resource and capability that that sector has, that even though a lot more money has gone into environmental causes, we haven't seen a kind of comparable impact. And there are lots of reasons for that. Partly it's because funders have been working in little silos on their own little pet projects and not connecting to each other. Partly it's because environmentally, people tend to have been focusing on kind of symptoms rather than systemic causes, not really kind of working with the overall system. And so what she and a gentleman called Andres from an organization called the BioLeadership Project, we came together to sort of say, well, can we create a space to allow funders to operate differently? And the kind of guiding star of the lab, the Earth Funding Lab, is to create economies that serve life. So it's a space where we're bringing together funders of all different kind of colors and stripes to come together to say, well, how can we sort of learn and unlearn about what it means to have an economy that serves life and about what it means for our own practice as funders to be able to try and bring that about? So I kind of lead one of the three work streams in that lab. And
what does your day-to-day role in that look like? What are you doing?
Also in that, I mean, it's a relatively small part of my day-to-day life. And the majority of my day-to-day life is spent on the Teal Collective and the clients that we have there. But within the Earth Funding Lab, primarily I'm leading one of our three work streams. So the work stream that I lead is specifically looking at how might our tax system evolve to support the greater thriving of life. At the moment in the UK, we have a very unfair tax system and also a tax system which incentivizes a lot of the behaviors that we don't want to see and disincentivizes some of the good stuff. So in direct relationship to what we were talking about earlier, for example, there is VAT on repair and restoration of properties, but there's not VAT on kind of starting from scratch. So it's cheaper for people to build a new home than to restore an old one, for example.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about this yesterday. They were saying they were buying a property, but they didn't want to renovate. They didn't want to renovate it. They wanted to knock it down and start again because they wouldn't have to pay VAT then.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a perfect example. I was just talking about that yesterday.
I mean, yeah, and it's completely crazy. And everyone who looks at it from the outside goes, well, that's mad, because why wouldn't we make use of it? And often people are like, oh, well, there's lovely features to older homes that I'd like to keep and have homes with more character. And it's often much cheaper. Well, like you would think as an individual to be like, well, I'd rather kind of keep some of these things. It's certainly much cheaper environmentally to not use a whole load of new resources and so on. But yeah, at the moment, our tax system is completely skewed away from a lot of the things that we want to see. So the work stream that I lead is about helping these organizations to identify where are those little acupuncture points, i.e. where are the little interventions that we could maybe support as funders that could have bigger ripple effects into the broader tax ecosystem. So
how would you get that funded?
So the people in the lab are funders. They're representing philanthropic organizations with money to give away. So we are identifying the initiatives that they might want to put their money into that will have ripple effects.
So if you were, for example, right, so you're talking about the tax system,
yeah,
and the VAT, how would somebody fund that? Are you talking about funders who want to make a profit?
No.
Giving away money for charitable causes.
Yeah, for philanthropic causes, yes. So
philanthropic charitable.
Yes.
Is that what that means?
Philanthropic means, yeah, like for good, no profit expected. You know, they often also have investment arms, which will expect a return of some kind, but often they can do that in a more patient way, i.e. they can expect a lower level of return or over a longer time period. So they can invest in things different to, say, a venture capitalist firm or would do.
So these people would fund you to do more research about VAT or to influence that?
So the way it's been working at the minute is, so in my work stream, we collectively did some research. We invited a whole lot of speakers in. We did interviews to kind of give us a bit more of a connection to the field of organizations who are already working in the space of tax justice in different ways. And that allowed us to develop kind of a picture of, well, here are a few ideas of things that might need more support. Like, oh, there's this amazing initiative that's happening, but it's tiny, you know, it needs something to really help it launch to the next level. Or we identified a theme where there's a whole load of fantastic kind of pockets of work, but they're not well connected to each other. So what if we helped to either bring them together through an event or hired someone specifically to be what we call an ecosystem weaver, to connect those spaces, to help them to meet and know one another? How can we also help the amazing work that they're doing to meet, to connect with policy makers, whether they're kind of within government, but also kind of people in the media who massively influence the agenda? How can we be engaging with them? And so how can we develop roundtables to sort of help? Because there's so much data which demonstrates that actually the majority of people in the UK are happy for there to be higher taxes, provided they're fair, i.e. overwhelmingly on people who are much richer. So the majority of people wouldn't pay more, but the wealthy people and institutions pay more tax in order to fund the stuff that we collectively want, that we do want good public services and we do want a just transition. We don't want our future to be completely trashed by climate change. We would like our children and our grandchildren to have some kind of feasible future. So people are saying, actually, yeah, when I listen to some evidence, I would really like that. But there's, again, there's this narrative in government that goes, oh, and we heard that play out in the recent election massively. We can't possibly talk about increasing taxes because people freak out. And we go, actually, if you increase the taxes on people with over £1 million worth of assets, for example, by 1%, and you increase people who have over £1 billion of assets by 2%, you get over £50 billion of income every year into the government, which more than resolves the restoration of the NHS. You know, you, if you make sensible choices with tax, you can really dramatically transform society. But there is an absolute cowardice in our current leadership to actually be able to talk about this topic, because they're just afraid people will go, oh, I'll run away from that. And it was just devastating, I think, to see the really damaging rhetoric in the recent election, where it was just like, taxes are evil. And it's like, it really depends on what tax you're talking about and on who. Mm. I think most people would agree that fossil fuel companies should pay more tax. I think most people would agree that Google should pay more tax. You know, I think most people would agree that Rishi Sunak should pay more tax. You know, it really, really depends what you're talking about. And it's been used as a massive excuse to not make some really important decisions that would benefit all of us.
Oh, oh.
I know.
Was that actually a noise? That was a noise. That was a nice little break. We just started going off on a tangent there, and we were like, well, we need to press record.
Some good stuff.
Cross my legs, I'm getting comfy now. Harvey's having a right cuddle with Hannah. He likes you.
So nice.
He knows that you're a super person.
Oh, thank you, Harvey.
So just to summarize, as a designer, if I was to say, make a point of every time I have a supplier meeting to talk about what are you doing to be regenerative? What are you doing to be more sustainable? How are your products adaptable and built to last? Is that a good thing to start doing?
I think I think asking questions is a massive thing. I think starting with that it's really important to you and that it's a key part of how you want to do business, whether you're talking to a supplier or a customer, is key. I think it completely then just sets the frame. And I think it's often really surprising. People have an assumption about what won't be important to people. They're like, oh, if I mention this, customer's going to think I'm barking up the wrong tree. No, it's been really interesting to me in so many spheres of life when you've just gone in and been honest and said, this is something that I really care about. How many people have been relieved to have the permission to say, me too. And I'm so glad that we can now talk about that. So be honest about it being a priority for you if it is. And I'd say, secondly, I would say be upfront about wanting to build long-term trusting relationships, to say, look, I want to build a relationship with you, no matter what that context is, that is not just about a transaction, that I want us to be able to be honest with you about the challenges that I have in my business and for you to have in yours. And you may not be able to say it like that in each meeting, but like you said earlier, to be cultivating intentionally relationships with customers where you can say to them, look, I obviously need to make a return on this, and that understanding is there, and where your supplier could say the same thing to you and go, if we do that, then we're going to have to cut this corner, and how do you feel about that? So I think that's a massive thing, is trying to build relationships with that trust and vulnerability and honesty in.
So what if a designer wasn't as in a position that I am where I can say no to mm-hmm. something if I don't want to do it, and they needed the work. Would you have any advice for someone like that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, because I think there might well be lots of people thinking, oh, well, this is all very well and good if you've got enough money coming in. And I think that is a really crucial question, because as with the tree framework I mentioned earlier, when you think about money as a nutrient, you don't want too much. No organism out there wants too much, but you also need enough. It's absolutely crucial that this is not about sacrificing yourself. This is about making sure that you have enough to do the work that you want to do well. So it absolutely is crucial that you have that. I would say that from the experience of setting up the Teal Collective, when I set up the Teal Collective, what I did intentionally was to try and make it really lean, really low overhead, so that I'm never in a position of having to compromise our values, our principles, what we're here to do, because I need to get that job in. Because there might be a scenario where that happens at some point where, whatever, I fall on hard times and things change. But the intention of the business is to try and reduce those overheads as much as possible, so that I'm not in the place of going, oh my God, I have to pay 10 salaries at the end of this month, so we have to take this job, even though it's totally not in line with our values. I want to avoid that possibility as much as possible. So I would say that you can never, I'm certainly not going to sit here and say that person out there, if you're in a position where you have to take a job because you need to survive, you have to. I'm certainly not going to tell you not to do that. But I am going to say that you can try and design your own organization from the beginning to give you as great a chance as possible of being able to prioritize the values that you care about. And so maybe it's about making it a lean organization that means that you can really adapt and respond to the scenario and not have to compromise. It's also about some of those fundamental questions, like I mentioned earlier, like setting yourself up organizationally, legally, as an organization that can prioritize the greater thriving of life over profit. If you set yourself up as a shareholder-owned organization with a company, a limited liability company, the overwhelming legal leaning, you are immediately setting yourself up in the direction of prioritizing short-term profit. The organization that I run is an organization limited by guarantee, which is a legal structure available in the UK, which means that legally, my organization can only ever use the money that it gains for its purpose. It can never be something that I sell and make millions of pounds from. It means the legal structure guarantees that the money that comes into this organization is used to further its mission. So there are lots of things that you can do as an organization to making the regenerative choice more easy, make it more natural, the sort of general direction the organization is pointed in. But absolutely, you need to make sure that you have enough nutrients. But often the answer to that is by asking yourself, do I really need to have 10 offices? Do I really need to have X, Y, and Z? Or can we do things lighter in a way that means that we can actually prioritize the quality of what we do?
Yeah, I mean, just while you're saying that, I was thinking in COVID, we got a lot smaller, our business, completely restructured, and we're now a much smaller business in terms of people, but I subcontract out when I need to, and we're a lot more profitable, and we're a lot less wasteful in terms of the way that we work, because we've restructured and made it smaller. And that has put me into a position where I can say no to things. If I've got a client who's behaving badly or saying that they don't care about the environment, for example, not that anyone's ever said that to me, but I can say no to things and stuff like that.
Yeah. So. And I think that's priceless, isn't it? Like that ability to be able to say we can act in congruence with our values. Mm. That's something that...
How free is that?
Yeah. And the kind of amount of well-being that brings is really hard to put a price on.
Mm. I wouldn't be doing this podcast if that hadn't.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I was curious about having had this chat and thought about things in the way that you clearly have. I wonder, do you have thoughts for yourself, like experiments you're going to put in place in your own business, or things that you are interested to maybe try another time?
Yeah, I came up with an idea a minute ago when we were chatting, when we were supposed to be recording, where I think with the library, that we've got quite a large library with all different samples in, which I love. As if anyone has listened to this podcast, they'll know I love my library. And I've decided to put a corner of the library to a sustainable corner. So anything that, any supplier that comes in and we have a material that is recycled and recyclable, goes into one bit, and maybe have a secondary one that's recycled but not recyclable, one that's recyclable that's not recycled. You could go manually, but I think maybe having a corner of the library where it is our go-to, that's the first place we go to, which has got all of the recycled material, I think would be a really nice start. I know a lot of them anyway, and I do go to them, but I also write, one of the things I already do, which may or may not appeal, is that I've got a permanent marker at, sort of on my desk. And whenever I have a supplier come in who's got a recycled product, I write recycled on it. So you can clearly see it. Mm. So in a year's time, when I've forgotten all about what that person had just said to me, I can go to that book and go, well, that's all recycled. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of thing, I think, is really important. But yeah, that's my take home on it.
Lovely.
Today.
Yeah. And I, one other organization I haven't bigged up yet, which I just love to just throw in as we come to the end, was Interface Carpets. So Interface have done amazing things in terms of trying to reduce waste. So carpets, you'll know much better than I do, can sometimes be quite difficult to remove, and also often use like quite toxic glues to hold them down. And they have developed, they used those little lizards called geckos that like can shimmy up glass and they've got like incredibly sticky feet that means that they can climb on all these kind of amazing surfaces. But it's not, obviously they don't use any kind of glue, it's like this amazing, I don't know, texture to their feet, which means that it can grip really hard, but also can release really easily and so be removed really easily. And Interface examined this, the way they do it, and they've now developed a version that they use on their carpet so that their carpet never has, it's really easy to take up bits of it and replace it so that you don't have to replace the whole lot. It's really easy to remove it. There's no use of any toxic glues, and it's really easy to reuse it because you lift it up, you cut it into a different shape, you put it down somewhere else. It's, there's none of that kind of, oh, in order to pull it up, we have to rip it into pieces and it becomes completely unusable. So they have done some amazing things in their design, which have been totally about looking at how does nature operate? How can we use more of that inspiration in what we do? And I would just encourage any designer out there to just be thinking to yourself, and like I would say the ultimate practice, and I do this in my own business, whenever there's like any different challenge that comes up or a new question I'm grappling with, my first thing is, what does nature do? Go outside, have a walk around and be like, when nature has this problem, whatever it is, what does it do? What happens? There's actually an amazing website called Ask Nature, which you can actually type your question in and it will tell you like, oh, this is how nature responds to this if there's a precedent. Yeah, that is just the ultimate source of inspiration. When I talk about what it means to be regenerative, creating conditions for the greater thriving of life, the great news is we already have the world's best teacher, because nature has been creating conditions for the greater thriving of life for 3.8 billion years. We have all the wisdom, all the answers that we could ever need. We just need to learn to listen and to use it. So it's, yeah, I think it's actually a really reassuring thing to remember that when you're grappling with something and it's, oh, how on earth am I going to do this? So often the answer is just like under our noses if we learn to look.
Well said. I just want to say thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it and respect your time for coming in and doing this, because I know you're a very busy lady doing all the things that you do. And yeah, no, I really appreciate how you've taken the time to want to educate designers as well. So thank you from our community, because I'm sure everyone will have a take home from this. And yeah, thank you for coming on.
Oh no.
Hannah Temple.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I want to make a round of applause. The amazing Hannah Temple.
I'd be bowing to those of you not watching. But yeah, thank you so much. Such a joy to be here with you, with a friend. So lovely. And I've actually just remembered one last shout out, which is just on the point of designers. I'm part of something called the Life Centered Design School, which is run by someone else. I just chip in as a contributor, but it's a beautiful initiative. I'd really recommend anyone checking it out.
Life Centered Design School. So I'll put all of this in the notes.
Yeah.
And your contact details in the notes as well.
Of course. Please be in touch.
Yeah. And seriously, the Green Party, I never thought that I would be there, but meeting you and listening to all of the things that you said, I actually am totally in, and I really wish I'd voted now, because I didn't vote because I was just like, I'm not voting for them lot. And now I'm like, I wish I'd voted for Hannah.
Oh, that's green. That's just amazing to hear. I do think things are really changing. And yeah, I certainly had never had any interest in being a politician ever growing up, but I just like we talked about earlier, legislation and regulation has such a massive impact on our lives and our jobs and, and every aspect. And it just seems to be pointed in just the wrong direction. And I think I just got really sick of waiting for better politicians to come along and just felt like if we want things to be different, we need to use every channel available to us. And so if you are curious out there, get involved, find your local parties, get involved in it. I would just really recommend it and make up your own mind about what's right for you.
Just so you know, the day after I met Hannah, I told her that I think she should be the Prime Minister. And I genuinely think that. I think she would be amazing. Just saying. I'm going to leave you with that. Later.
It's on the record now.
Thank you for listening to the Interior Design Podcast. See you next time. Thank you.